On the program today, 5 days in this economy in 5 live minutes. How you feeling out there, American consumers? Also, a new face in late night from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 15th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A whole lot of nuts and bolts in the business and economic news of this week. So we are going to dig right in, see what we can make of it. Catherine Rempel is with The Washington Post. John Harwood is with CNBC. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. The Ides of March, as it happens. So, Catherine, let us begin at the beginning of the week. The president's budget came out, his budget proposal. It should be clear because this is just a plan. What, as you were thumbing through it, did you learn?
I think there were a couple of things that stuck out to me. One, of course, is that this budget, which we should emphasize, does not have much likelihood of making it into law, but it is a statement of priorities. It continues his priorities of further upward redistribution of wealth by extending the tax cuts, and then, of course, increasing funding on defense and the wall, but also kind of balancing out those increased costs through cuts to lots of safety net services. So Medicaid, food stamps, SSDI, that sort of thing.
Right. Social Security and disability insurance.
And then the other thing that stood out to me was the economic forecast, which was way out of whack with what everybody else is predicting. The White House says we should have we should expect around 3% growth as far as the eye can see. Pretty much every single independent forecaster outside of the White House says otherwise. The reason why they do that is because that's how they get their math to add up.
That's how they get the budget to balance. But, John, let me ask you this, though. When you have people like Mick Mulvaney, who is a budget hawk, if ever there was one, coming out of the White House as chief of staff now saying, yeah, this budget's good. And, you know, Larry Kudlow, whose economic forecasts have been of debatable reality at best. What do we make of that?
The budget is astoundingly unrealistic. And I would correct you on Mulvaney. I would say he is not a budget hawk. He is a size of government hawk.
That's fair.
He doesn't care about the balancing of the budget nearly so much as he does shrinking the role of government and what government does. And the reason I say astoundingly unrealistic is that neither Republicans or Democrats who are going to be in charge of actually writing the budget are interested in cuts of the magnitude that the administration is proposing, even if you set aside the unrealistic economic forecasts. They did very deep cuts during the Obama administration that they have sequentially been rolling back over the last several years. The same thing is likely to happen this year. The real budget is going to come when the House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, lift the so-called caps, which are headed to squeeze down, cut both defense and non-defense alike later this year. That's where we're going to decide what actually government spends its money on.
Catherine, let me go a little bit sideways here and cast us forward into early-ish to mid-2020 as we really start thinking about the presidential campaign. Do you think size of government and budget deficits and the national debt are going to be an issue?
Unlikely. If you look at the polling data on how much people care about deficits, their concern about balancing the budget, getting debt under control, that sort of thing, has been declining over the last few years, which is a little bit ironic because, of course, deficits have been rising over the last few years.
It's a lot ironic, actually, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's partly because people don't necessarily have a top-of-mind number for what the deficit is, for what the debt is. They have a vague sense that it's too big, although why they think it's too big is also often a little bit muddied. Yeah. The government should be like a household, which is a bad analogy, but I feel like I hear that a lot from readers. So I don't think that it'll be that big of an issue. Where it could be an issue is if the economy happens to take a turn, which we may be overdue for, given how long this recovery has been going on, and if there isn't the fiscal space that we need because we have built up so much debt to have a stimulus package or what have you, then it could be an issue.
John, go ahead.
But, guys, I would say the size of government debate will be squarely in the next campaign because the American people have made clear as they've gone further and further without fundamental increases in their standard of living that they want more help from government. In our NBC Wall Street Journal poll a couple of weeks ago, we asked, 55% majority said they want government to do more. That's what Democratic presidential candidates are pushing on the campaign trail.
Well, and they're also, Catherine, just to bring this full circle, they're pushing Medicare for All. A lot of them are on the Democratic side. So it is, you know, John might have a point.
Yeah, that's definitely true on the left. I think whether that will how that will play in the general election is questionable, right? Because Trump has seen that it's a useful boogeyman for him to claim socialism, whether or not the policies on the left are actually socialist. And, you know, that term, we can debate what that term actually means. But if it means big government and people are scared of big government, then maybe that message will become less powerful for whoever the Democratic nominee is going into.
Historical note,
Ronald
Reagan called Medicare socialism. It passed, and it's pretty popular right now.
And you know, look at the profile of some of the people who are being branded as socialists and call themselves socialist, right? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie. I mean, you know, it's out there in the atmosphere, right?
That's true. Although Beto O'Rourke, who announced entered the presidential race this week, called himself a proud capitalist. He had a small business in tech services in El Paso. And so I think that Democrats are going to be talking about regulated capitalism, capitalism with rules, rather than getting rid of capitalism. Elizabeth Warren says the same thing.
Right, she does. John Harwood at CNBC, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. That was a Monday through Friday wrap-up. That was legit, actually, what it was supposed to be. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we will see you later on. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, traders, well, they went into the weekend on an up note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ann Arbor, Michigan is whence today's Big Picture Economic Indicator arrives. Every month, the good people at the University of Michigan put out a survey of consumers from which we get a report known as Consumer Sentiment. And this morning's report showed that the early March sentiment of we, the American consumers, is pretty good. Thanks. The current sentiment index was up more than 4%, and expectations for the future were up more than 5%. And yet, there is a growing pile of economic data that points to a slowing economy in manufacturing and retail, home building as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tries to square that circle.
What are consumers feeling good about? You got to start with jobs. The Labor Department just reported near-record job openings, and a lot of people are voluntarily leaving their jobs to get new ones. That's what 26-year-old Justin Hurdle of Arlington, Virginia did recently, moving from the private sector to a nonprofit.
Being able to be comfortable to take a pay cut from where I was, I know I'm lucky, make a decent living, have a good place to live.
Kim Goodman's feeling solid, too. She's 50 and loves her job managing an ethanol plant in St. Louis.
My husband and I both have jobs. We have insurance. We have what we need. Family-wise.
Not so great. Her 20-something sons are struggling.
And I watch people lose their jobs and lose what they were going to do the rest of their life. I would feel easier about the economy if things just didn't bounce all over the place all the time. Stores that you never thought would close. Now they're done.
And that positive but cautious consumer attitude is widespread, especially among people in their 20s and 30s who often have student loans to pay and ladders to climb. Caroline Sharp is 35. She's an independent video producer in Los Angeles. Her husband works in the film industry.
We talk about buying a house every once in a while and do the math and come up with that it's not really feasible yet. We don't have children yet, mostly because of the expense.
She's pretty confident the house and the family will come if only the economy can stay in good shape like it is now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Busy day on Wall Street today, which we kind of knew it would be going in part because today is one of the 4 days a year that the S&P 500 index does what's known as a scheduled rebalancing. What, you might rightly be wondering at this very moment, is a scheduled rebalancing? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on rebalancing explainer duty today.
If you want to track a market that's ever-changing, you have to change too. Howard Silverblatt is with S&P Dow Jones Indices.
Our goal is to emulate the U.S. market. So when you say the S&P 500 did something, that's what the general market did.
It's not trying to beat or outperform the market. It's just trying to mirror it. If one particular industry gets a dramatic new look, the index wants the name of its hairdresser.
We look at the U.S. market and say, okay, 20% is in technology. So the index, if it wants to emulate the market, has to have 20% in technology.
If the tech industry grows to 21% of the market, the index will need to adjust.
If that's out of balance, healthcare could have also been out of balance because, again, the market adds up to 100%.
And while the S&P 500 wants to mirror the broader market, there are lots of other index funds or ETFs that want to mirror the S&P 500. Linda Allen is a finance professor at Baruch College.
This is the cool kids table, essentially, in the stock market because of the importance of the index.
S&P Dow Jones Indices estimated this rebalancing would prompt $32 billion in required index trades. Ben Carlson is with Ritholtz Wealth Management.
So places like Vanguard or iShares, Charles Schwab, places like that that have index funds that track these indexes, they have to make changes so that their fund reflects what's in the index.
The funds make these changes so individual investors don't have to. Their investments track the index without any effort on their part. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Busy day on Wall Street today, as we knew. We'll tell you more about that later. It's been a little while, but there was a whole period there a couple of months ago where the watchword on Wall Street was my favorite five-syllable word, volatility. Who wins and who misses out? When the markets start moving around, we took a look. It's at marketplace.org. '18 was looking for a while there like it was going to be a lousy year for the American solar power industry. The Trump administration put 30% tariffs on imported solar panels, and it set quotas to physically limit imports as well. But the future of solar, and apologies in advance, but I honestly, I don't know any other way to say this. The future of solar looks pretty bright. Goldman Sachs was out with a report this week saying solar installations are going to be up 30% this year. And as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, last year might not have been as bad as some had feared.
Tariffs did drive down how many solar panels were bought for industrial, commercial, and utility installations, according to a new study by the Solar Energy Industries Association and consultants Wood Mackenzie. Overall, solar installations were down 2% from the year before.
Those tariffs are like a drag, right? They're like this unnecessary weight.
That's Abigail Ross Hopper, president of the Solar Energy Industries Association. Residential installations, though, those went up. That's because despite the tariffs,
solar prices have fallen 47% over the last 5 years.
Plus, there's a federal tax credit for going solar. And some states offer subsidies, says Severin Borenstein, who teaches energy economics at UC Berkeley. The panels are only a third of the cost. The rest is installation. And that's down, too.
Residential installers are getting better at figuring out how to efficiently put panels on houses.
The solar industry expects the number of new panel installations to double over the next 5 years. That's something Peggy Marker is already seeing.
We've definitely seen an uptick in solar, I would say.
Marker runs a construction company in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Tariffs have had a significant effect on her business. She swapped out steel and granite for cheaper materials, for example. But when it comes to demand for solar panels,
the past probably year and a half, it's become more prevalent.
Florida's solar industry is one of the fastest growing in the country. According to the recently released National Solar Job Census, it added over 1,700 jobs last year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In the working world in general, there has always been a bias against mothers.
And in the venture capital world specifically. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 138 points this Friday, 0.5%, 25,848. The NASDAQ rose 57 points, about 0.7%, 76.88. S&P 500 up 14 points, 0.5%, 28.22. For the week, the Dow gained 1.5%, the NASDAQ up 3.7%, the S&P 500 2.8% to the good. Boeing said today that a software upgrade to its 737 MAX 8 and 9 series jets is going to be rolled out in the coming weeks, which is great, but then the FAA has to certify it. Don't forget that. The company stock closed up 1.5% today. Boeing shares still down more than 10% for the week. United and Air Canada said that the 737 MAX issue could hit their bottom lines. United shares up about 0.25% today. Facebook continued to slide a day after two of its top executives resigned. Company shares raised 2.4% today. Tesla unveiled the Model Y crossover vehicle yesterday, and analysts promptly began worrying about the company's already pressured cash flow picture. Tesla down 5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Y'all know the standard founder startup trope in this economy, right? Some young guy, because inevitably it's a dude, drops out of college, has an idea, makes a pitch to a bunch of venture capitalists, gets a bunch of money, and then boom, everybody's a billionaire. Slight exaggeration on the billionaire bit there, maybe, but the rest of it is pretty much spot on. Venture capital money in this economy goes overwhelmingly to men, leaving would-be female entrepreneurs at a structural disadvantage, never mind women who want to start companies and who also happen to be pregnant or thinking about it. Liza Boyd covers Silicon Valley. She wrote recently in The Guardian about female founders going public with their pregnancies and forcing venture capital to adapt. Liza, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We will start with the reality, with the non-pregnant reality of women and startups and venture capital, which is that female founders get a vanishingly small fraction of venture capital money.
That is true. It's a little over 2%, according to PitchBook, and it's been that way for at least 10 years.
And what happens then to female founders who show up visibly pregnant, and they've got their deck and they're in front of the VCs, and then what happens? I mean, there's an amazing quote in your piece: I can't fund you, you're pregnant.
Yeah. So historically, women founders have been advised to not get pregnant if they're planning on fundraising, and if they are pregnant, to try to keep it on the down low. And a lot of that is because even to this day, the vast majority of investors in VC are men, and many of those are men who have wives who stay at home, women who may have been professionals, but at some point decided to leave the workforce. And so a meaningful portion of those investors are going to picture their wives and say, I can't invest in this company because this woman will kill my investment, because as soon as she has a child, she's going to leave.
Yeah. And there's a cultural component of this as well. I mean, the host of our tech show, Molly Wood, was interviewing Katrina Lake of Stitch Fix, obviously. And she tells a story, Katrina Lake does, of being in a conversation with a well-known but shall remain nameless here venture capitalist who said, yeah, you know, I take most of my pitch meetings in a hot tub. And you're like, really? You know, right? And what female founder, let alone a pregnant female founder, is going to slip into a hot tub?
Well, I mean, there's definitely a much larger conversation going on in Silicon Valley of sort of discrimination, harassment against women. But I think it even goes broader than that. In the working world in general, there has always been a bias against mothers. And again, we have to remember that for a long time, the working world was created by and for men, and none of these issues were things that were designed into the original framework of companies. Interestingly, there is beginning to be emerging evidence that says that mothers, parents, but since women tend to bear the brunt of the job of caretaking, are actually some of the most productive employees. And that's because they don't have time to waste.
You write of a bunch of women founders, pregnant or new mom women founders, who have recounted their experiences to you. And you say that the founder's mindset is shifting, right? That they don't think that they have to work, as you say, 100 hours a night to make this company work. The question, though, is what signs do you have that the venture capital mindset is shifting?
So there's some really great examples. I spoke with Rachel Carlson, who's the co-founder and CEO of Guild Education. It's a Denver company, and they've raised $70 million. Last year, she became pregnant with twins, and she was coming up on her due date. And she definitely was thinking, I'm not going to be rushing to close a Series C, because once I'm on maternity leave, I am going to be out of the equation for a certain period of time. But there was an investor in Silicon Valley who was so excited about what they were doing, that he hopped on an airplane with a gift basket with two baby blankets in it and said, I am ready to sign now. This one investor wasn't looking at her baby bump. He was looking at her numbers.
So it's not quite easy yet in Silicon Valley to be a female startup founder, but it's easier, right?
I think the needle is moving, and I think there's a bunch of different reasons for that. On the venture side, you both have more women and more younger women who are themselves getting pregnant and having kids. They know it can be done. And then, you know, you're beginning to chip away at the edges on the male side with more and more men, again, looking at the numbers rather than the sort of ancillary things.
Liza Boyd lives and writes in and about Silicon Valley. Liza, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Yes, I missed the news that Carson Daly is done with his late night show, which I get, by the way, he's been doing it for 17 years. The new news, not missed, thank you very much, is that NBC has decided who's going to replace him. The new talent is an Indian-Canadian comedian named Lily Singh, whose YouTube channel has 14 million subscribers. So first of all, YouTube to a network show, but also a new face in a late night lineup that has looked pretty much the same for years now. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Lily Singh's YouTube videos are a mix of skits, funny commentary on her Punjabi heritage, and witty social observations, like her guide to going clubbing and timing out your pregame.
Ladies are free before 11, so you need to leave at 10:15. This means you need to start drinking at 9:15 to give yourself approximately 60 minutes to get tipsy.
This video has 30 million views, by the way.
And if you fall behind, that's disrespectful.
She's really outgoing. She's a natural. She's fun to watch. She's unexpected.
That's Susie Maines, a talent manager. She says it's a huge moment for NBC, especially since Singh is younger, has a huge audience, and isn't another white dude.
I had a breakfast this morning, and the topic instantly with a producer that I had never met was about Lily Singh.
Each of Singh's YouTube videos is estimated to bring in tens of thousands in ad revenue. But moving to Carson Daly's late slot following Seth Meyers brings a lot of advantages. Here's how she put it on Jimmy Fallon's show last night.
What's the show going to be like?
YouTube channel, but just, you know, now I have more than three staff members. And it'll be like, and my sound guy won't also be an extra and won't also write the script. So
a bigger staff and a bigger reach. Late night shows still command hundreds of millions of dollars in ad revenue. Still, with TV audiences getting older, Brian Steinberg at Variety says NBC is hoping to get the Peacock logo onto as much viral content as possible.
Anyone who's not using social in addition to the linear broadcast is foolish because there's a whole generation of people who just watches shows that are passed around as clips.
He says that'll let NBC tap into Singh's existing audience and keep the late night buzz going until dawn. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
A correction here from yesterday's broadcast. That robot story that I did, the mall security guard, they are not as expensive as we said they were, closer to $50,000 to $100,000 a year. This final note on the way out today. I don't know if you caught the Duke-Syracuse game last night. Duke won 84-72, but that is not why I bring it up. College basketball is not my thing, so be it. First game back, though, for Duke freshman Zion Williamson after his Nike shoe blew out a month ago. I'm sure you saw the pictures. USA Today reports that not only did Nike send a whole team of people to campus the day after Williamson's shoe fell apart, trying to make things right, he had a sprained knee, but then that same team went to China to keep an eye on production to make sure that Williamson's replacement shoes were made the right way. In Nike's defense here, it ought to be said that Williamson is 6'7", weighs 285 pounds, and is apparently crazy fast.
Thank you.
All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 138 points on this Friday, 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 57 points. That is 0.7%. The S&P 500 gained 14 points, about 0.5% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.